the 34th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 1st of March 1977. Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, The Beast of the Sea and the Rise of the Papal Power, and the reading, Revelation chapter 13.
My dear brethren and sisters and class members, following the exalted theme of our special effort, I believed, therefore have I spoken, we once again recommence our class activities. And I believe that it's very good that we should develop our ecclesial routine, and therefore let us open our class this evening by singing together hymn number 22, followed by prayer. Hymn number 22. As I mentioned, brethren and sisters, I believe it is good that we once again recommence our study for this year, that we might partake of that regular diet, in particular around the book of the Apocalypse. Now, Brother John this night will speak to the title, The Beast of the Sea, The Rise of the Papal Power, and Revelation chapter 13 will form the basis of his exposition this night, and will be led in that reading by our brother Graham Travers.
Reading together the 13th chapter of the Revelation. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it was wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwelt upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns, like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon, and he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword, and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And that no man might buy or sell, save that he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that understandeth count the number of the beast, for it is the number of man, and this number is 666.
Thank you, Brother Graham. The Beast of the Sea, the Rise of the Papal Power, the 13th chapter of the Book of the Apocalypse, our Brother John.
Dear brethren and sisters, dear young people, well, it's, 3 months since we gathered together in this fashion to consider the Book of Revelation. I suppose many of us felt sometime last December when we concluded our classes that the chances of seeing the opening of the 1977 class year was possibly somewhat remote, that with the way the world is heading, that one could expect the return of the Lord Jesus Christ at any time. But life goes on seemingly endlessly, doesn't it? Month goes past, year goes past, and still the Lord hasn't returned. It's very easy, of course, for us to settle back into a state of lethargy, and whilst we give lip service to the fact that we say the Lord is coming, in our heart we start to feel that there are many other things that we should be planning for, and so the return of the Lord slips into the background of our thinking. And my thoughts were prompted along those lines as James, in his prayer this evening, reminded us in paraphrasing the words of Ephesians chapter 5, that we must redeem the time because the days are evil. And Weymouth, in his translation of that verse, says, "Buy up your opportunities because the days are evil." And I think it would be a very good thing if we felt that in every meeting we attended, in everything that we did in the truth, that this was perhaps the last meeting or action or activity or whatever it might be that we were going to accomplish before the Lord returns. And I know, as far as my own preparation of the class is concerned, and doubtless your own presence as a member of the audience in a class is concerned, if we could take this attitude with everything we did, I'm quite sure we would attack it with much more vigour, with much more enthusiasm, with much more dedication, thinking that perhaps this was the last opportunity to fill our minds with that little bit of the Spirit word that we need that will help us as we prepare for the near advent of the Lord. And so my mind was prompted even more so on these thoughts when, as I said, James in his prayer paraphrased those words from Ephesians chapter 5, "Buy up your opportunities." And so we come then to the commencement of our class year. We look at the book of Revelation and we say, well, we're looking at chapter 13 tonight. And we're going to look at some beast that's all about the Roman Empire in the past. And whilst we say, look, it's marvellous the way the book of Revelation's written, perhaps in the back of our minds at times we say, well, yes, but I must admit that some parts of it don't really do anything for me. Well, brethren and sisters, what we want to do, and of course I'm going to endeavour to help you in this regard, but each one of us must make our own effort to realise that God has put all of these things here for a very definite reason, and that this vision of this beast, while it may depict some ghastly system which has existed in the world down through the ages, nevertheless the whole thing was intended to be an exhortation to us. So if we don't immediately see the exhortation as we read chapter 13, we've got to try and look at it a little more closely, and I don't necessarily mean delve into all the meanings of the words, but try to look at it through God's eyes and say, why did he give John this particular picture? What exhortation was there in it? Well, let's hope that our next few moments together are going to try and depict that exhortation as John saw it. Well, we're going to start off our class with our good perennial transparency as a means of revision for all of us who've been coming, and perhaps for those who haven't been along before, to set out before us once again the structure of the apocalypse as we've been considering it now for 2 years. We've got the various colours there presenting to us the various phases of the apocalypse as they are set out on the opening chart of our notes, what we've styled a thematic outline of the apocalypse. They're just set out in a different fashion. We noted that the first 3 chapters consisted of the foundation vision. And then following the key phrases of the apocalypse, which John has recorded there, where he says, "After these things I saw," or "After this I beheld," all of those key phrases which show to us John's own divisions, we then go on to the next section, which is chapters 4 to 6, the vision of the rainbowed throne and the sealed scroll. Then we come to chapter 7, the vision of the 144,000. Then we come to that section which we are now considering, the largest section in the apocalypse, which goes from chapter 7 verse 9 through to chapter 15 verse 4. And we've seen there 3 various phases of the judgments which God is going to pour out upon the Roman world. We see first of all in chapters 8 and 9 the 7 trumpets, God's judgments on Catholic Rome, on that universal Roman system. We see in chapter 10 the culminating judgments on Catholic Rome. We come to chapter 11 and we see the 2 witnesses, and we consider the contemporary developments which took place in the Western Empire. Now we're looking at this section of chapters 12 and 13, the dragon and the beast of the earth, what we have styled contemporary developments of Christendom. So whilst the subject of the trumpets can be located in a certain geographical sense to what we have styled Catholic or universal Rome, and whilst also we can talk about the Western Empire as being geographically defined, this other section which we're looking at here in chapters 12 and 13, whilst of course there are certain geographical features about it, The main thing about it is that it is describing to us a system, not just so much a geographically defined empire or power, but a system. And that wherever this system might be, it is going to come under the judgments, the culminating judgments, described ultimately in chapter 14 through to chapter 15, verse 4. And so, for those who perhaps haven't seen this chart before, the purpose of the chart was to explain the reasons we believe why the apocalypse takes us right through to the end and then comes back again and starts with another vision. This has confused many people over the years, and they wonder why it is that the book of Revelation can't just start at the beginning and go right through to the end like that. Well, it's because it's set out thematically. And therefore God takes a theme through to the end and then comes back and starts another theme which may be parallel with it. So in that black section, which goes from chapter 7 verse 9 through to 15 verse 4, there are in fact three parallel themes: the judgments on Catholic Rome, the judgments on the western section of the Roman Empire, and now this last section we're coming to, which is the judgment on Christendom. Now, the judgment on Christendom, as we've seen, is depicted in the form of a judgment on a series of beasts, each one developing out of the previous one. And I thought what we would do this evening, by way of revision for those who've done it before, and I think it's a very important basis for those who haven't done it before, is to go back by way of introduction to Daniel chapter 7, because that's where it all starts. Now, I would suggest that we shouldn't only have our Bibles open at Daniel chapter 7, but we should also open up our notes at that chart, which is found opposite page 138, the Kingdom of Men chart, because this seeks to link together the vision of Daniel with the vision of the apocalypse. Now, this is very important. It's some years since we've done a study of Daniel, and there are some here who've probably never done a study of Daniel, at least in a class. Now, if we're going to understand Revelation chapter 13, we've got to understand Daniel chapter 7. Now, we're not going to do an intense study of Daniel 7, only those relevant features which are going to be important for the basis of chapter 13. Now, here in Daniel chapter 7, we've got a series of beasts. Just to help us in picturing these, we have the first one presented before us on here on our transparency, which represents the first beast described here in Daniel chapter 7. Let's start though from the beginning of the chapter. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. We know that the beast set out in Daniel chapter 7 are very similar to the metals which were set out in the image of Daniel chapter 2. There is, however, a fundamental difference. The fundamental difference is this, that the image of Daniel chapter 2 was a dream which was dreamed by Nebuchadnezzar. The beasts of Daniel chapter 7 was a dream dreamed by Daniel. Here then are two completely different views of one and the same subject. Nebuchadnezzar was looking at the kingdom of men through man's eyes. He saw it as a mighty warrior, probably a warlike figure. He saw it in all its glory as man would visualize the kingdom of men. That's the way that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about it when he went to sleep. Daniel, on the other hand, with the mind of the spirit, sees the kingdom of men through the spirit's eyes, and he sees it as being composed of beasts, the final one being so dreadful and so terrible that it was indescribable and no name could be found for it. So here then in Daniel chapter 7 we are looking at the Spirit's view, at God's view of the kingdom of men, culminating in this dreadful beast which becomes the basis of the vision of Revelation chapter 13. We noticed also as we're reading Revelation chapter 13 tonight, didn't we, that this beast was, we were told, was like a leopard, its feet was as a bear, and its mouth was the mouth of a lion. A lion, a bear, and a leopard. All taken, you see, from Daniel chapter 7. So that's why we're going back to Daniel chapter 7 by way of introduction. So here then in Daniel chapter 7 we are introduced to the first of the four great beasts which came up out of the sea. They were diverse one from another. The first one we're told in verse 4 was like a lion. It had eagle's wings. And I beheld, says Daniel, till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now this lion with eagle's wings was a very familiar sight to the people of Daniel's day and to the generation before, because the city of Nineveh, the city of Nimrod, and those other cities of the mighty power of Assyria frequently had displayed around them beasts with eagle's wings, lions with eagle's wings, and they have excavated just such beasts. So when Daniel presents to us a picture here of a lion with eagle's wings, it would have been a well-known symbol to the people of his day of the great Assyrian Empire. Now, the Assyrian Empire was very closely related to the Babylonian Empire, because it was Nimrod who built both the city of Nineveh, that's the capital of Assyria, and the city of Babylon, which was the capital of Babylonia. So when we talk about Assyria and Babylon, we are in fact talking about very closely related powers. That's why Brother Thomas often talks about the Assyro-Babylonian power or empire or kingdom. And so it is here in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 4 that the lion is shown as being in two stages of its development. First of all, it was the lion with eagle's wings, but then he watched till the wings were plucked off and it was made to stand up upon the feet and given the heart of a man, as we see it depicted on this slide here. And so when the Assyrian Empire fell to its sister kingdom of Babylon, there was a change. The wings were plucked off, the lion stood up upon its feet, and it was given the heart of a man. Because as bad as Babylon was, Assyria was worse. Assyria was a dreadful warlike power, whereas the dynasty of Nebuchadnezzar was somewhat more humane. It was less of the animal than was that of the kingdom of Assyria. Putting the two of them together, of course, we have a marvellous representation of the latter-day Russian Catholic Confederacy, because the Assyrian was the great warlike type of Gog, whereas the Babylonian was more the religious type of Rome. And so the latter-day Russo-Roman Confederacy is here depicted in its earliest stages by the lion with eagle's wings, and then the second phase where it was caused to stand up with the heart of a man. Now note, this was the basis of the vision. Just as the head of gold was the thinking power of the image, so the lion was the first fundamental animal. In other words, God is telling us that the whole system is Babylonian to the core. It started right back in Genesis chapter 10 with Nimrod, this great man who stood up in defiance of Yahweh. And so the system was Babylonian. And whilst the kingdom of men, as Brother Thomas tells us, may be diversified in its constitution, its extent, and its throne, from the days of Nimrod to this present time, it has nevertheless been the same Nimrodian kingdom with Babylon and Assyria for its characteristics. So says Brother Thomas on pages 3 and 4 of Exposition of Daniel. The kingdom of men today, brethren and sisters, is as much Babylonian as it was in the days when Nimrod built the Tower of Babel. Just as much. So when we come over to Revelation chapter 13 later on, and we find that this beast, or this phase of the beast that he's looking at there, has the mouth of a lion, it's telling us that it's linked with this Babylonian lion. And the fundamental principle of Nimrod was that he was a great hunter before Yahweh. The word before meaning in defiance of. And that's it. That's the principle of Babylon, a principle which stands in defiance of Yahweh. A world today which stands in defiance of Yahweh, brethren and sisters. And therefore, even at this early stage, we can begin to see the exhortation. This is the world in which we live. Never let us forget that all of the nice people around, with all of their plausible arguments, who nevertheless reject Yahweh, are the latter-day Nimrods. They are the latter-day inhabitants of Babylon, and fit, unfortunately, only for destruction. We say unfortunately because God himself is not willing that any should perish. But inasmuch as this whole world which is about us is part of this mouth which speaks like Babylon, we realise that for our own sake, if the Lord does not return in the near future, those things which come out of the mouth could well seduce any one of us away from the truth. And there's not one of us that's strong enough in our own right that we can withstand the very plausible reasonings of Babylon. And so the whole of the book of Daniel presented to us this picture. The very contests which Daniel and his friends had with Nebuchadnezzar was an attempt on the part of Babylon to draw these young men away from their God. But the strength of the word within them caused them to see the ultimate vision and to be able to withstand. And so as we study this vision this evening, let's realise that it's strengthening us in our resolve to recognise the world for what it is, and to realise that the return of Christ is in fact the only solution. And if he doesn't come soon, how many of us are still going to be coming to the meetings? How many of us are still going to be Christadelphians? We don't know, do we, brethren and sisters, who it is that could be drawn away from the truth purely by that mouth-like doctrine of Babylon, which is as powerful today as it ever was. And so here in Daniel chapter 7 then, we've got the basis of the mouth of that beast that we're going to look at in a moment in Revelation chapter 13. It is the Babylonian beast. We know, of course, that historically the Babylonian beast was replaced by another empire. The Babylonian beast was replaced by a bear. The bear is also referred to in Revelation chapter 13. Historically, the Babylonian Empire fell. We know the story, it was replaced by the Medes and the Persians. But the thing that we must always remember, and that I think is one of the most impressive things in reading Brother Thomas's exposition of Daniel, is that he reminds us that whilst it was now Persian, it was still Nimrodian. In other words, it still traced its origin back to Nimrod. It hadn't really changed. All that had happened was its borders had changed. The kings wore different sorts of clothes. They may have had a few different rules, but it was still the mouth of Babylon that dominated the world. You might remember those words. He says that in taking a general survey of the contents of the book of Daniel, it may be seen that two great powers are the principal subjects of its predictions. The one is styled the kingdom of men, the other the kingdom of God. It is true that there are many symbols, such as the image, the fiery furnace, the tree stump banded with brass and iron, the four beasts, the ram and the he-goat. But these are signs in the prophetic heraldry, not of kingdoms distinct and independent of those which have preceded them, but of one and the same kingdom of men in the several phases of its existence. It will be seen that the kingdom of men has been diversified in its constitution, extent and throne since its foundation by Nimrod to the present time. It has nevertheless been the same Nimrodian kingdom with Babylon and Assyria for its characteristics. So even over in the apocalypse then, when John looks at this beast, which is fast becoming a papal beast, hundreds of years after the time of the Babylonian or Persian kingdoms, the lion is still there, the bear is still there, and the leopard is still there, because the characteristics never change. And if we were to draw up a picture of society today, it's still all there. It's just up to us to recognise it. And so there was the bear. In Daniel's day, the bear raised itself up on one side. It had three ribs in the mouth of it and between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, "Arise, devour much flesh." It was lopsided because the kingdom was a twofold kingdom. It was a Medo-Persian kingdom. But inasmuch as the Median section only lasted for 2 years, and the Persian section for over 200 years, therefore it was higher on one side than the other. And the fact that it had three ribs in the mouth of it, there were the three presidents, of which Daniel was one of them. described in chapter 6 and verse 2 of the book of Daniel. In other words, the mouthpiece or the presidents was a threefold one of the empire as it was in Daniel's day. Well, the Babylonian Empire was followed by the Persians, and the Persians in turn were followed by the Greeks. This brings us to the third of the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, and again one of the three constituent elements of the beast of Revelation chapter 13. This is the leopard, described in verse 6. It answers in general terms to the brazen or copper belly and thighs of the image of Daniel chapter 2. And we can see this, of course, as we look at our chart that we've got open there. Daniel 7 verse 6 says, "After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it." And so he's presenting to us here the picture of the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great was the first great king of this empire, but on the death of Alexander the Great, he left no sons, and so the kingdom was divided up amongst his four generals. And this is presented to us here as the beast having four heads. We've come to get used to the idea of heads on beasts representing various powers, kingdoms and so forth. And so here now this beast has four heads, answering to the fourfold division of the Grecian Empire on the death of Alexander the Great. His four generals were named Ptolemy, Lysimachus, Seleucus and Cassander. And these four generals fought amongst themselves until they got to the stage where there was only two of them left, the Seleucidan descendants and the Ptolemaic descendants. The area which was previously headed up by Lysimachus and Cassander had been incorporated into the other two. And so this answers, of course, to what we've got in the vision of Daniel chapter 2, that it wasn't only the belly which was of brass, but the thighs. And this is the top part of the legs. So the Grecian Empire was divided into two parts. These came to be known as the kings of the north and the kings of the south, later on in Daniel chapter 11. Anyway, we've passed on then to the third kingdom. This third kingdom was finally replaced when Rome moved east into the Grecian Empire and absorbed the Grecian Empire into the Roman. There is quite a distinct difference, of course, between the way in which the various empires fell. And the difference is this, that whereas Cyrus the Persian overthrew the Babylonian Empire and Alexander the Great overthrew the Persian Empire, it could never truly be said that the Grecian Empire was overthrown by the Romans. It was never really overthrown. It just so happened that Rome moved in progressively, and Rome absorbed Greece, even as Greece, to some extent, absorbed Rome. And so when we come now to look at this fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, it can be seen that whilst it is a Roman beast, there are Grecian elements in it. You see, it didn't only have iron teeth, but it had brass claws. The brass answering, of course, to the Grecian element of the image. And that is why Brother Thomas will use such terms as the Greco-Roman beast. To quote a very well-known quotation, the historians say that it was captive Greece that took Rome captive. It was captive Greece that took Rome captive, so that whilst the legions of Rome marched into the Grecian Empire and exerted the rule of Rome over Greece, it was the Grecian philosophers who absorbed these legions and handed them their gods, and the Romans said, well, we can use these. And so all of the gods of Greece, which they previously got from the Babylonians anyway, were taken over by Rome. So that when we read in the book of Acts about Diana of the Ephesians, that was the Roman name of the Greek goddess Artemis. And so there were all the other counterparts of all of the other well-known gods as well. So who really won
Was it Rome or was it Greece? Well, it's very difficult to say. What we've ended up then with is a Greco-Roman system. But it's a Babylonian one, and it still comes down. Now, when we look at this beast here in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7, he says, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly." These words, dreadful and terrible, give us some idea of what the beast probably looked like, because it's an unnamed beast. The word dreadful, which is used here, is a word meaning to cause fear, which comes from a root, I understand, meaning to slink or to crawl. In other words, it was some sort of beast which had the characteristic of crawling or slinking along the ground, whilst the word terrible, a word meaning to cause terror, but again coming from a root meaning to be burly or mighty. So when one puts those ideas together, that it was a mighty beast, a burly beast, and yet it slinked or it crawled along, possibly the nearest we can get to this is something of the idea of a crocodile, such as we see depicted on that particular drawing there. But the spirit doesn't see fit to line it up with any known beast. The characteristic of the lion, the bear, and the leopard could doubtless be applied to the various characteristics of the preceding empires. But when we come to this great Greco-Roman empire, a thing so dreadful and so terrible, the deity cannot find any name to describe it. And so this beast now, which we're going to find described here in Daniel chapter 7, is broken down into finer detail in the book of Revelation. Notice this chart. Look back at your chart on the kingdom of men. See, right over on the right-hand side, it's got the beast of Daniel chapter 7. The fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. We're told that it remains till Christ and the saints destroy it. But all of these other beasts, the beast of Revelation chapter 12, which is the great red dragon, the beast of Revelation chapter 13 verses 1 to 10, which is the beast of the sea, and the beast of Revelation 13 verses 11 to 18, which we call the beast of the earth, these are all a breakdown of this general beast which we're looking at here in Daniel chapter 7. And, as Revelation shows to us, it also incorporates all of those beasts that have gone before. So we're looking then at a system that might be pointing specifically at the papacy, but in general terms it's telling us that the whole world is affected by this system. So there really isn't anything good in the world outside of the truth. There's nothing good in the world outside of the truth at all. Well, in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel describes this beast for us. He tells us that it had great iron teeth in verse 7, that it brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. It was completely different. It was totally different. And it had 10 horns. The reason it was going to be totally different is the very reason that we were trying to point out in our original transparency as we looked at the breakdown of this section of Revelation. Babylon, you see, was a geographically defined empire. Persia was a geographically defined empire. Greece was a geographically defined empire. So was Rome at the start. But the ultimate development of this beast, which intrigued Daniel so much, was not an empire which you could geographically define, but it was a system which would penetrate all of the corners of the earth. Consequently, it was a beast which was diverse from all of those that were before it. Something the world had never seen before. A system, a papal system, which would penetrate every part of society. And whilst we may think it doesn't penetrate us, what we want to realise is that when we go out of this place tonight, that whatever we see outside here is in some way or other affected by this Babylonian, Persian, Greco-Roman beast, because that's what the whole world's made up of. And outside of the truth, there is nothing but this beast. It had 10 horns. Well, by this stage we're quite familiar with the principle of the 10 horns. The 10 horns were the 10 kingdoms into which it was divided. when the Goths came down and they invaded the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire was eventually taken up into Europe, and it was divided amongst the Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Gepidae, the Lombards, the Franks, the Suevi, the Alans, and the Bavarians. These are the ten horns. Daniel presents to us now, though, a change in the state of this beast, because he says in verse 8 of Daniel chapter 7, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, what we've got here is this. Verse 7 describes the beast as having ten horns. That particular phase of the Roman beast is amplified in the great red dragon of chapter 12, and in the beast of the sea of chapter 13 of Revelation. The later phase described here in verse 8, when he saw a little horn come up that plucked up three of the other first horns by the roots, is amplified in the description of the beast of the earth of Revelation chapter 13, and the mouth which spake great things is described in further detail by the image of the beast in Revelation chapter 13. So what we're saying is this, that what Daniel describes in essence here in about two verses, Revelation describes in two chapters. And it breaks it up into other beasts. And whilst they all look like this one, they are a more detailed description of it. So essentially tonight, when we get back to Revelation 13, we're going to be looking at a more detailed description of these ten horns. Then, God willing, in subsequent studies, we'll look at the others. But while we're here, we might as well complete Daniel's picture of it before going back to Revelation. He says, I considered the horns. He looked at these ten horns. And whilst he's looking at these ten horns, he sees coming up in the middle of them another little horn. And before this little horn, there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And in this little horn there were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Historically, this can be understood in the period of history around about 758. At this time, the Lombards, which were one of those ten horns previously described, had controlled that area of Italy which particularly interested the popes. They had gained control of that area, and the popes wanted to get rid of them. And so the pope, which was Pope Leo at this particular time, looked around for someone to assist him in order to relieve him of the oppression of these Lombards. And so he looked to the north, to the area which we know today as France. He looked up to the area which was ruled over by the Franks. And up there there was a man by the name of Pepin, who was king of the Franks. And he appealed to Pepin for help against the Lombards. So Pepin sent his son down to help. And his son's name was Charlemagne, which in French means Charles the Great. It was Charlemagne, this son of Pepin. And so he came down and he rooted out the Lombards. He got rid of one of these horns. And then after a series of conquests, he defeated the two other powers which were particularly oppressing the popes, namely the Vandals and the Huns. And as a result of that, he cleared the area of Italy, at least this particular area, to make it free for the popes to have complete control. And so this new little horn, which in fact was a papal horn, arose up as a result of the Lombards, the Vandals and the Huns, three of these first ten horns being rooted out by Charlemagne. So Charlemagne then, being the political figure, and the Pope being the ecclesiastical figure, agreed between them that they could now exert their influence right throughout Italy. And so it was that on Christmas Day in the year 799, as Charlemagne was at Mass in St. Peter's Temple in Rome, Pope Leo crowned him Emperor of Rome. That's in the year nearly 800. But you know, the emperors had gone years ago. Imperial Rome had passed away hundreds of years before. This is an interesting thing, because we're going to see in the book of Revelation that speaks about the reinstatement of Imperial Rome in a slightly different way. And so we're told that the people cried out, "Long life and victory to Charles, the most pious Augustus, crowned by the hand of God." The hand of God being the hand of the Pope, of course. So that by the annexation of Italy, Charlemagne also annexed the Roman Church. He plucked up the horns of the Vandals, the Lombards and the Huns, and in so doing, he'd inserted a pair of eyes and mouth into this little papal horn of which he regarded himself as the ruling brain. He thus laid the foundation of the Holy Roman Empire. And that'll be the beast of the earth of a later study. So that's what Daniel chapter 7 is all about. It presents to us then this dreadful and terrible fourth beast, which is the culmination of these others. And of course the climax of the vision is that in verse 11 he says, "I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame." Now this is interesting. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season at a time. He says the fourth beast was completely and totally destroyed and his body given to the burning flame, but the lion, the bear and the leopard had their lives prolonged for a season and a time. A season, according to Brother Thomas, is a period of 280 years.